Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Last week, we presented Professor's fifth talk in this series, and today we'll be continuing with yet another question and answer session based on Professor's earlier talks in this series. And the questions will be posed by a panel of, and the panelists are Radio Sai's B. Shuprushti and Sri Aman Javeri, a research scholar from the Department of Management Studies at the Institute. And as always, Professor G. Venkatraman will be answering and clarifying the questions put up by the panelists. So over to Professor for his opening remarks and taking it further. Over to you, sir.
Sairam, dear listeners, and greeting from Krishanthi Nilayam. I do hope you realize that we are discussing a subject called Dharma. It has come to a stage where instead of following Dharma, we are talking about it and wondering how to follow it. That is the Kali, beauty of the Kali age. But this problem of how to follow Dharma seems to have been there for a long, long time. And that is why Guru Charan Das went to Mahabharata. And this series, the book written by him was sort of a double helix with Mahabharata forming one strand and today's life forming another strand. And using these strands, he was trying to deduce a formula for Dharma for the Kali age. And when I read the book, I felt there were many finer points that were not brought out. And those finer points are available to us from Swami's teachings. And today, the panelists are going to examine how well I know what Swami has taught. So please pray for me.
So, as you mentioned, sir, that there are some finer points in this discussion of Dharma, which you noticed and which we also felt that are the missing links in this discussion on Dharma. And one of the things that I noticed is, as you mentioned in your talk, that Adam Smith also talks about people having an altruistic side to their lives.
Absolutely.
Yes, he talks about it. And you also mentioned about...
I go to the extent of saying economics was a subpart of moral sentiments.
Yes, yes.
Ethics.
Yes. And... in fact, you mention, you quote Amartya Sen and you say that how the origin of economics is actually this ethics and engineering, the two approaches. And it was largely ethics and somewhere down the line it has moved on to engineering. And in the end you say how Guru Charan Das says that, you know, being good and living a deeply moral life, if you can be skeptical about God, but if you are good and you live a deeply moral life, then that is the way forward.
See, basically, Amartya Sen said it was the story of the Arab and the camel. So, camel was the engineering part.
Yes.
Tent was the, what you call, the Arab sitting in the tent was the ethics part.
Yes.
So, ethics has been driven out. Driven and the out. Tent is occupied by the camel.
Yes.
So, Amartya Sen says, give man a chance, at least let him put one foot or one little hand inside.
Yes.
So, that is the inversion, moral inversion we see in today's world.
Yes.
And as I was trying to say, Guru Charan Das is trying to read the Mahabharata and say, can modern man get any lessons from the story of the Mahabharata? In my view, the answers to the questions asked by the people in Mahabharata is to come when the war is about to be fought. That is when Krishna teaches Arjuna the Gita. And I don't know whether Arjuna taught it to others. So, Bhishma, the Yudhishthira and all these people were literally in Guru Charan Das state. Because Dharma had not been clarified by the avatar yet.
Correct.
But they were trying to behave in a good way, dharmic way.
Yes.
But now that we have the teachings of Krishna, we don't have any excuse, alibi.
I think that's a very important
that
point.
That is the point I'm trying to say.
Yes.
So if he goes to those people who are basically ignorant but had it in their guts, how is he going to find out the secret?
Correct. So and as you very rightly mentioned in the very first talk, I think you put it very succinctly that everyone was like Guru Charan Das at that time trying to find answers, and the answers came in the Gita, but somehow the author here has not looked at that. And if we also try to find solutions to everything,
it looks like they got out of the movie, they were bored and they got out. But in a way, that is the point.
Yes, yes.
Even if the Gita is available today, people do not realize that's where you get the answers.
Correct.
They are very skeptical about it. And so people read it at funerals. Swami said, what is the use of reading? The man is dead and gone. It is you who have to follow. He bluntly said that. It is a common practice to read the Gita at the funerals. It's of no use to the man who is dead and gone. And that is exactly what people are trying to do. They are rubbishing it, trashing it, and they are not able to go beyond the limitations of their sensual perception.
Yes. The only thing here is, you feel happy that, yes, everyone agrees that, you know, you have to lead a deeply spiritual, deeply moral life, and you have to be good. But they are of the view that God need not be in the scheme of things.
Yeah, that's the question. Who is God? What is God? We go around saying there is no God, there is God, on the basis of what we believe is God. This is an important point. Most of this discussion has come at the present time from the West.
Yes.
So their perception of God is basically leaning on the God of the Old Testament. The God of the Old Testament looked like a person like you and me, perhaps. And he was working like a strict auditor and accountant, plus police and judge. So he will go on finding out whatever minute faults, and then say, this guy should be punished, and this guy should be tortured, and so on and so forth. But God in the abstract can be truth. Gandhi said, God is truth, and my way to truth shall be through non-violence.
Yes.
So, if you say there is no God, are you saying there is no such thing as truth? Then comes the question, what is truth? Was there any truth before man appeared? Was there any truth before there was creation? Such philosophical questions come. They can be answered in a certain way, but people are not prepared to accept those answers. Then comes the question, how did the universe come out of nothing? Today we have the unassailable scientific fact that our universe did have a birth 13.86 billion years ago. There's a lot of scientific evidence. The error in that is about 2%. So there was, as Lemaitre said, a day without a yesterday. The day that,
yes,
there was. Now there is a scientific as well as a philosophical question. How could this universe come out of nothing? Is there a mother to the universe? These are questions that are being raised by many, and Roger Penrose has written an excellent book called Cycles of Time. It is too advanced mathematically, but the concepts are understandable. And he has given not only a theory for a previous universe, he has also given many suggestions about how the genes of the mother can be detected in this universe.
Oh.
We all have our mother's genes in us, in part. That's natural. So if this universe was born out of a mother, surely the mother's genes must be here. And he has given a convincing argument and said, these are the things you will find. And he has asked the scientists to look at the early cosmic history, what is called the cosmic microwave background, and see some patterns. And if they are found, surely there must be a mother. Then people will say, of course there must be a mother. How can there be a baby without a mother? Then he asks the question, how far does it go? Does it go endlessly or stop? If it stops, who is that? Now, from Vedanta, we say it stops at Akshara Brahman, which itself is derived from Kshara Brahman. Sorry, Kshara Brahman, who is derived from Akshara Brahman. That's how Aurobindo puts it. So Vedanta makes it very clear. If you are saying there is no God, basically you are saying there is no Vedanta, there is no Bhagavad Gita. Because Bhagavad Gita is just the Vedanta made into cream. with sugar added into it.
My question is,
yes,
here, including Amartya Sen and Gulcharan Das, they are saying that it doesn't matter whether you believe in the existence of God or not.
Correct.
You believe that you have to be good and
correct,
you have to lead a deeply moral life.
Yes.
If you believe in this, that is enough. That is good. That is, that will solve all the problems, and that is a solution sort of to the modern problems related to dharma. Do you think that is workable in the current scenario? If someone says that it doesn't matter, I don't have to really go to the church, I don't have to really believe that there is an existence of God, but I am leading a moral life. Now, moral is again in quotes. Is there a problem in that scenario?
There is a structural weakness, because the word moral is not defined. That's problem number one. And as I've explained in my last talk, there are two words. One is called ethics and the other is called moral, morality. Current usage seems to suggest morality is related to the behavior of an individual. Ethics is related to what society expects of you. So, one of the rules of ethics is, don't pay bribes. It's a rule that society is supposed to be telling each one of us, don't give a bribe. Morality is a personal preference. Okay. Ethics tells us that you don't do this because it will harm society. But an individual does something. He says, I will not marry, but I will have a friend. So this is my personal choice. What's wrong with that? This kind of questions arise, and the answers, the hard answers are avoided by decoupling the individual from society. Now, Swami says, society and the individual are interlinked. The moment you say the individual has nothing to do with society, in fact, Margaret Thatcher went to the extent of saying, there is no such thing as society. Then what do you govern? Don't you not make rules for society? It's sort of for some political and economic reasons that is brushed aside. Unless the individual has character, there will be no national character, Swami said. In that sense, supposing the individual doesn't have character, nobody will have character. So the behavior of the individual will affect society as a whole. You cannot legislate some rules for society and tell the individual, go ahead, you can do as long anything you want, as long as you don't affect society. So there are certain behaviors I can have which affect only myself. There are certain behaviors which I cannot have because it will affect society. Take drinking. If I drink, I'm going to ruin my health and maybe die. But supposing, in order to give me a drink, there's a big alcohol industry. A lot of people start drinking. And a lot of people, children start drinking. Then it becomes a societal problem. This is happening in Russia. The economy is not in good shape. And the moment you leave the metros and go to the interior, lots of people have no job. They drink and ruin themselves and die. In other words, we are trying to discuss a nice kind of framework in which the individual and the collective are not connected. That connection exists whether you like it or not. And everybody will be affected. I'll give you one simple example and stop there. We used to have cartoons in the Doordarshan in the old days. People keep their house, sweep it, and throw the trash on the road. Everybody does that. So the trash is, garbage is all on the road. And when there is an accumulation of garbage, diseases are bound to crop up. And whom are they going to affect? All of us, we are part of society. So we are basically inventing clever rules and end up by shooting ourselves in the foot. So I don't accept a sort of fudgy code of conduct where ethics is there and immorals, individual morality is there. They both must be consistent and they must both have a frame of reference. What is the basis on which you do? If somebody kills somebody, you say it's a crime. Who said it? You are saying it. And the same people will say, will wage wars where they will go and kill people. What do you say to that? So these things must be thought out. And there must be a framework which we have to follow. But it must derive its authority from something else. In fact, in Gurcharan Das's book, when Draupadi is molested, he says there is a higher law from which we must derive answers to these questions. There comes a point where you are left groping.
Yes.
And I say you don't have to grope. There is a higher law.
I think what will happen is...
This has to be discussed at length, but I hope you get the point I'm trying
to make. Yes, sir. In fact, I remember this was also raised in the first Q&A which we had, where I put up a question to sir that, sir, somebody like Amartya Sen is an atheist. Then doesn't it mean that he's a good man? And I remember sir talking about a moral GPS and then something which is universally acceptable, because then everybody, if nobody has a frame of reference, everybody comes up with their own answers. And that is exactly what is happening today.
Yes. But one of the things is, I don't want to damn people like Amartya Sen, they are very good people. Those people, intellectuals, intuitively have an internal reference on which they broadly agree. I should be honest. It starts with scientific work. When I do scientific work, there shall be no plagiarism.
Right.
That's moral code. I don't cheat. I don't hurt. I may hurt with words and debates, but I don't go around killing people. I buy a driver's license. I don't drive without a license. I pay my taxes. All those things are supposed to be what you call good conduct. So, conduct, good conduct, character, etc. are expected by these people.
Yes.
Yes.
That is implicitly understood. It's not defined. It so happens that these things overlap with what is recommended for a good person according to Vedanta. Yes. A good person shall not do these things. Moses said this.
Right.
Jesus said this. Scriptures, Vedas said this. So that kind of thing is innately in us, and we try to say that we must be like this. Even Richard Dawkins, who calls himself the devil's chaplain, says, we have got a very powerful brain. We have done fantastic with it, things with it. Now let us use our brains to be civilized and not have war, conflict, etc.
Sir, I want to ask you one question.
So basically, they say all these things. What we did in ancient times was, we said these things are expected of us from a higher power, and we do these things as showing our love for that.
Right.
That if that plug is pulled out, how will the engine run properly?
Sir, as a scientist, you have also mentioned that you have often come across people who internally somewhere accept the reality of these teachings, but in public they are probably a little bit shy to express their belief in these things.
You have to be politically correct in the public.
Sir, you would also have met people who are, say, agnostics or atheists, but who are really morally good, and they lead a good life. Sir, what explanation do they give for their morality?
They, basically, it's a question of, if I do this, if I violate this principle, I'll be inconveniencing others. It is not fair. It is not just. So there is a concept of fairness and justice.
Yes.
It is in there.
Yes. Sir, you also talked...
The only thing is, what is the meaning of fair? Why should we be just? People can ask. They say, when we are together, it is better that we live with each other and get along with each other instead of fighting and killing each other.
So, actually, even though they do not say that they believe in God, they are actually indeed leading a spiritual life, more or less a spiritual life, isn't
it? Let me put it like this. This is the sat-asat mixture.
Yes.
You see, we are not all bad, we are not all good. There is a mixture called sat-asat mixture. Truth and untruth exist. Untruth arises out of ajnana. So Swami says, you must have a filter and remove the ajnana part. That is purification. That is what sadhana is all about. It is what refinement is all about. But that calls for a traditional, rigorous discipline and all that. So people say, go to hell, that's not possible. Swami gave a very simple answer. In this Kali Yuga, you don't have to do all those damn things. You serve others, seeing God in them. Then you will serve the person. If Swami comes here, we will all stand up. We don't have to do it all the time, but we stand up. Then we try to be very respectful to him. We show only love to him. And he says, I am in you. I am in everybody. Yet, we don't recognize him as equal to God, Swami. We abuse him. We say, that fellow is an idiot. He doesn't know anything. Such a thing. Even that simple formula, we are not able to apply. Why? Because there are powerful forces of negativity within us. And thus we end up as a mixture of good and bad. Is there any way in which we can increase the proportion of good to a larger value than the bad? If we cross the 50% mark, we are on the right track. Otherwise, we are on the red.
Sir, as you said, you have to go back to the Guna's nursery for that.
That's right. You see, then you don't accept all that. Because essentially, so that comes from religion. I don't want anybody to tell me what I should do. That is the fundamentalism of today.
Yes, sir. So you talked about justice and fairness. Sir, you also made a very, very interesting point about compassion in Vedanta. And I really don't think that I have ever come across, in whatever little I've read, I have ever come across somebody who talks about Vedanta and then in the same vein also talks about compassion.
See, the compassion aspect of Vedanta is sort of hidden. You talk about Atman and all that as though it's attributeless. But if you look at creation, where did it come from? It came from the Atman. In the real world, you see A being compassionate to B. In the language of physics, you can't have something unless it has a root somewhere. So, by that kind of physics argument, the Atman has an element of compassion. That's why I have compassion, if at all. And to prove that point, or rather to establish that point, avatars come. Now, if you take Jesus, he was also an avatar like you and me, except that we don't call ourselves avatar because the word is reserved for the embodiment of pure, total purity. So, Jesus is always talking about compassion. Buddha is always talking about compassion. Our Swami is always talking about compassion. And somewhere back, you go, you say that is immanent in the Atman.
Yes, sir.
That is why Swami kept on saying for many years, Divyatma Swaruparara. He would never say, my dear student boys and girls and all. That came later. Yes. He's constantly reminding the spark of divinity in you. Don't use a battery given by devil. Connect your power source to this voltage, divine voltage. Then you will run properly. So derive the motivation for all your actions from me. The goodness that I represent, which is already in you. Don't derive the motivation for your action from the ego.
Sir, in fact, I remember I was reading the Dharmavani a few days back, where Swami has told that any action that you do with body consciousness is a dharma.
Exactly. That's why in my notes I will go on writing BC. BC means body consciousness.
Sir, another similar...
Do you know why he says it is a dharma? I am body conscious, I have to be, because when I am driving I must make sure that I don't go and hit another fellow. Body consciousness need not be necessarily a bad thing. Don't tarnish it. In a context, body consciousness becomes dangerous and undesirable. That is, my body consciousness is what makes me egoistic. I had a recent experience. A certain person I was talking to, Suddenly the person became very hot onto the caller and began saying, what you are saying is nonsense, this, that, I know better, I have done this. Like a scientist, I tried to explain. Person had gone beyond and began to be very vocal and aggressive. That is because I had contested something that he said. In a scientific debate, which is what I discuss, I tried to give some arguments for this. Arguments were, the door for discussion was shut off. Person got angry. Why? Because I contradicted the person. I know these things. I have a lot of experience. Actually, the person was wrong. Because usually when the logic is on that side, I agree. It was illogical. I have discussions often. We are trying to do something in science. One fellow will say, no, if you do that, there is this problem. The moment it's pointed, yeah, that problem is there, so maybe this is not the way to do it. So, otherwise we won't progress in science. And on the other hand, if there is a hypothesis, I'll try to do an experiment to see whether you're right or wrong.
Right.
If it is not right, then I'll say cautiously, my data does not fit your hypothesis, but it needs to be repeated and cross-checked by someone. I might have made a mistake in my experiment. That has happened. A few years ago, there was a famous announcement from Switzerland. They said they have found neutrinos traveling faster than light. Everybody said it's not possible. They also said it's not possible, we have to check. Finally, it turned out that the GPS system that they had used, they had not taken into account certain corrections. And if you applied all the, because they get signals from all that, everything is controlled by relativity. The calibration was wrong. When they took that mistake into account, this thing fell down flat. But there was no, what you call, throwing of hats and said you have lost and all that. Because right in the beginning they say this is an unusual result, but we have to double check it. And they double checked it and they found they were wrong, they admitted. No heads fell.
One more thing I wanted to ask, sir. Sir, you talk about faith and reason in the talk that you have given. Sir, I am quite intrigued by these words because when we read Shankaracharya's works, like Viveka Chudamani or Mandukya Upanishad, for example, sir, he continuously talks about reason. In fact, entire Viveka Chudamani is based on discrimination, which is an offshoot of reason itself. So my question to you is, when you talk about reason as in Vedanta, compared to reason as we see it today in economics, sir, what is the difference? That is number one. Number two is, sir, when we read Swami's literature, can we apply reason there? And if we are to apply reason there, how should we do it, sir?
Two questions. I have to find out more about the second question, but I'll answer the first question. Reason refers to asking questions and coming to an understanding. Roughly speaking, I don't remember the definition. We see a tree. Where did this tree come from? After a long process, you realize there are things called seeds, and the tree comes to the seed. Seed itself is a part of evolution, connected with life, and so on and so forth. So you come to an understanding on the basis of questions relating to facts you are aware of. Now, when you talk of Vedanta, it is beyond the mind and the senses. When I say there is nothing beyond the mind and senses, when Kushwant Singh said death is a full stop, there is nothing behind it, then if I say, no, there is an afterlife, it is called a belief, an irrational belief. However, sages in their meditation had experiences. So they asked, how do you explain experience? Even a scientist cannot explain it. He can feel pain. You can say when pain is there, this thing happens in the brain, this signals come, that signals come. There is no way of explaining it. I give you something and I ask you, what is it? You say it's sweet. I also say it's sweet because I experienced sweet, and by calibrating with my previous experience, I can say this. But if I don't have that experience, imagine a deaf man. You take him to a symphony concert. You hear it and you say it's beautiful. Beautiful is an experience. That fellow hears nothing. So you have something which he doesn't have, therefore he is shut off from that. These people had the ability to go beyond the senses. You are not able to go. Therefore you say that is nonsense. You can say it once, you can say it twice, you cannot say it 100 times, because there are people. You can say they are all misguided. So we call those people as blind faith. Adi Shankara had gone beyond that level. He has had mystical experience. Now in relation to that mystical experiences, he is trying to understand. And so he asks a series of questions.
Yes.
When I use the word I, it's a concept.
Yes, sir.
Because if it is my body, this I will exist when the body is dead. It is something going on in that body that I refer to as I. You know, if I do this, I have lost a lot of cells. So many atoms have gone. So as I change, I don't change. I have a fracture, and then the doctor says, this is a bad thing, I'm going to cut off your leg. As the I change. So we talk about I so frequently. It's a concept that is not easy to describe. As Saint Augustine said, everybody knows what time is, but few can explain it.
Yes.
So there are concepts like that. So in relation to philosophy, there are things paranormal. And if you don't believe it, that's the point of view. There is nothing beyond this, question 6 said, but that does not make it true. So I also always think of Viveka Chodamani and the rational question. That's a higher logic. And that even Das is, Gurchand Das is forced to accept there is a higher principle, moral principle, which we now would call as Atma Dharma. So, people don't want to accept it for their own reason. But interestingly, science is pushing them towards that frontier. Science today cannot discuss consciousness, but it is there. And at the operational level, you can say it's unconscious, it's conscious, and yes, things like that. But what is this consciousness? Where did it come from? Why does it go away when you die? What is it that disappears when you die? What is it that makes it suddenly come on? You don't put any switch. There are questions which are philosophical and also physical and material, which we do not understand. So, people ask those questions also. And they work within the framework of a higher logic.
Higher logic.
If you deny there is higher logic, then that's a problem. Just to complete this, we are taught trigonometry. Geometry.
Geometry.
Geometry that we learn is plane geometry, Euclidean geometry, yes, two-dimensional geometry. And that way answer questions and get marks and get ranks and all that. But none of the high school students know that there are many other geometries, but they become necessary. The King of Prussia asked Carl Friedrich Gauss, how much land do I have? The king's territory is big. And that land is part of the earth. Earth is covered. So Gauss realized he could not apply Euclid's geometry. He had to invent spherical geometry. And then calculate on that basis and tell the king, your majesty, you have so many hectares. He had to design spherical hectares, spherical angles, and so on. So there are things, if you have a need for it, you go there, discover them, and accept them.
Wonderful, sir. Amazing.
Actually, this consciousness, forms the basis for the conscience, isn't it?
It is. There is a thing called universal consciousness that Swami says Atma. Divyatma Swarupalara, a piece of that divinity, spark of the divine is in you.
Yes.
Actually, the spark of the divine is outside also. It's connected to the outside, it's connected to everybody.
Yes.
But we don't realize this is my own Atma.
Yes.
So you call it my conscience.
Yes.
Schrodinger raises this question. Is conscience personalized? My conscience tells me this, your conscience tells me this. That means your mind is telling you, your mind is telling you, my mind is. Conscience is only one, there is no plurality about it. He writes it explicitly. Austrian. And ultimately ends with Vedanta. He says Atman equals Brahman. Atman is the name given to consciousness within. Brahman is the name. Even outside is equal to inside. Inside is equal to outside. There is no deep inside, deep outside.
No, actually I remember in our awareness class, Sir had explained this beautifully. We asked this question, Sir, what is the difference between consciousness and conscience, which Swami always refers to. Sir gave the example of a balloon.
Yes.
And you know, when you blow up a balloon, the air inside and the air outside actually is the same.
Yes.
So Sir explained this analogy, and Sir said, the moment you prick the balloon, where is the air inside and where is the air outside? There is no difference actually.
Yes.
So within is the conscience, outside is
consciousness. In fact, I have three things, C1, C2, C3. C1 is being conscious. Animal is also conscious. When you get out of anesthesia, you are conscious.
Yes.
And this fellow is there, that fellow is there and all that. Conscience is a sort of moral alert from within. But this moral alert is in everyone. If you shut it off, so that you take the phone off the hook, it doesn't ring.
Yes.
That's what most people do. Buddhi is
the
taking the handle and putting it out. Or in cell phone, you just power off.
Yes.
Once you power off, you don't get anything. But this conscience which is in each is nothing but the universal God. As far as you are concerned, Swami said, your master is your conscience. Follow your master.
Yes.
Master is conscience. If you have done that, you have got 99% of dharma.
Yes, absolutely. I think once you have that GPS, then all your morality will not be flexible, your ethics will not be flexible, and since conscience, as you mentioned, doesn't change, it's same.
So we have to try to communicate with conscience all the time. That's what meditation is. And Vivekananda says, don't do all that. Constant remembrance of God is meditation.
Yes.
That's why Swami says, Namasmaranam.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Fantastic. That is the beauty of Swami's teachings. Ultimately, he has given us very, very simple things to follow.
Can I end? I don't know. It looks like we may have to end now.
Yeah, we have to end now. I was just saying this last
few words. Allow me to end with a beautiful story. This happened many, many years ago in Hyderabad. Swami was in Shivam. And he will get up early and have his bath. So while he is bathing, Kamavadani and others will be chanting Rudram, Shiva's Abhishekam.
Yes.
That's this thing. At that time, a gentleman with access to Swami came. And Swami, as usual, was wiping his head and all that and said, Eppudu vachha, when did you come? He said, I came just now. Then this gentleman said, Swami, I don't know Vedas. And I felt miserable when these people are chanting Vedas when you are having your bath. Then I would have also contributed to the Abhishekam and all that. Swami looked at Kamavadani, one of the scholars chanting the Vedas, and asked him, Yem Kamavadani, is there anything greater than the Vedas? And then he said, what, Swami? There is nothing greater than your name. Meaning, you don't bother if you don't know how to chant Vedas. Chant my name, and that is in more than enough. And in one of our bhajans, there is a very beautiful line which I fell in love with long ago. He says, Jo naam chahe wo naam bolo, prem se bolo, bhav se bolo. You can say any name, but do it with love. Apparently in the interview room, one foreigner said, Swami, all your Sanskrit names are very difficult. What do I say? Simply say, Swami, I love you.
Yes.
That becomes your chant.
Yes. Wow.
So, with that, I shut up. You can do the concluding formalities.
I just want to make an appeal.
Sure.
You always been making appeals to people, and even Sir has been requesting today, I want to make an appeal.
Sure.
I have been to the listener, sir.
Am I a listener? okay.
Sir, you are the giver, we are the receivers. No, sir, I have been reading a little bit about Swami's, what Swami has written. And in today's talk, I felt that sir has subtly covered points from Sandeha Nivarini, where sir talked about Sat Asat.
Yes.
He talked about Gita Vahini, where he talked about the body doesn't change. Swami has so clearly mentioned. Sir talked about Dharma Vahini. Sir talked about Satyasai Speaks.
Yes.
Sir has spoken about nearly every aspect what I have read about Swami. And I'm
Jesus
sure I'm
Christ,
not
Christ, you're flattering me.
No, I'm not.
I didn't even know that.
No, I'm not. What I'm trying to say is, I this is my personal feeling that if all the listeners who are listening to this also make a little attempt to read about Swami and then listen to Sir's talk, I think they'll be able to appreciate this much, much more.
Yes.
And we'll be able to put into practice Swami's teachings much, much more than what we've been able to do now. That is
full
what
disclosure, I didn't promote that promo.
Fantastic, I think.
No, this is what I felt. So
absolutely.
I'm honestly
there's
sharing
more
with
that needs to be said. And sir has very clearly mentioned in the Gita, in this talk, that how Lord Krishna conveyed in the Gita is what Swami has explained to us elaborately, is decompressed
yes.
that in more than 700-800 discourses that Swami has given. So I think there's nothing more that we have to do than read Swami's teachings, and that has come out very clearly. Thank you very much, Aman, for coming from the university, and sir, of course, I really thank Swami that we are able to have someone like sir explain to us these concepts in the current scenario. I mean, looking at the problems in the current scenario. And we will continue this Q&A perhaps the next week also. Before we move on to the next chapter, once sir gives his next chapter from based on the book, The Difficulty of Being Good, the current chapter we are discussing is Duryodhana's Envy. After that, it's the story of Draupadi starts. So until sir gives the talk, we will have this opportunity of having question and answers based on this first chapter, Duryodhana's Envy. So if you have any questions or queries, dear listeners, please feel free. As always, you can write to listener@radiosai.org.
I am beginning to have the one problem, which is the difficulty of giving talks about the difficulty of being good. So let us hope I am able to finish one
more. We'll just
talk.
Pray to Swami that He gives you more strength and energy. Yes. Over to Sunil.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end the 7th question and answer session based on Professor G. Venkatraman's earlier talks in this new series based on Dharma. We hope you like the session, and next week we'll be continuing the present series. So please don't forget to tune in then, and we shall alert you in advance with web and radio announcements about what's coming up the next week. So watch out this space. We thank you for listening, and as always, with a podcast of this program may be accessed via our website www.radiosai.org. And dear listeners, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. And coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment Service, Love in Action. Thank you, and Jai Sai Ram.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Govind Krishna Vithala Venu Gopal Krishna Vithala
Govind Krishna Vithala Venu Gopal Krishna Vithala
Govind Krishna Vithala Venu Gopal Krishna Vithala
Vithala,
Vithala Venu Gopala Vithala. जय कौसल्या नंदन राम परमानंद आनंद राम जय कौसल्या नंदन राम परमानंद आनंद शराम जय प्रशांति साई शराम
जय प्रशांति साई शराम
जय शिरडीश परति शराम जय प्रशांति साई शराम कौसल्यानंदन राम परमानंद आनंद राम।